Imagine going to your doctor and finding out your genetic makeup. Researchers at ASU are working to make that a reality.
Devices like this, coupled with modern computer machine learning technology, will actually do things that no human doctor could ever do.
I'm Mark Brody. Today on the show, the potential for a DNA sequencer in every doctor's office. Also, the holiday shopping season is upon us, but all those doorbusters and deep discounts could spell trouble down the road. U of A wants to make sure its athletes are showing up for class by hiring other students. And do you know where your donation dollars are going?
Fundraising is a necessary called evil of the business. If you want to raise that kind of money, you're going to have to spend the money to have somebody go out and do it for you.
Plus, Maricopa County becomes a guinea pig and new regulations for telemarketers. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Look for the clouds to stick around for the rest of the afternoon. We're looking for a high temperature today of 71. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-50s. Partly cloudy tomorrow with a high of 75. It's 65 degrees right now at KJZZ. And on the Valley roadways right now, quite a different story than this morning's commute. Just one problem spot to tell you about. It's on the US 60 eastbound, an accident blocking the exit ramp at Gilbert Road. Immigrant rights advocates have urged an appeals court to reject Governor Jan Brewer's bid to put on hold its ruling that blocked her policy of denying driver's licenses to young immigrants who have avoided deportation under an Obama administration policy. Attorneys for the immigrants made the request to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals as the governor plans to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review her appeal of the July decision. The Ninth Circuit found there was no legitimate state interest in treating young immigrants who are granted deferred action on deportation differently from other non-citizens who could apply for driver's licenses. Instead, the panel suggested the policy was intended to express hostility toward the young immigrants, in part because of the federal government's policy toward them. The recount in Arizona's 2nd Congressional District race is underway in Pima County. Republican Martha McSally beat Democrat Ron Barber by just 161 votes, triggering the recount. From Tucson, KJZZ's Kate Sheehy reports.
It has been a tug of war between both campaigns and individuals to change how and why votes are counted in this tight race. Half of Pima County is in District 2. Brad Nelson, County Elections Director, says the recount is completely transparent.
All of this is being done under observation by political party observers. We also have an individual from the Arizona Secretary of State's office here observing the process as well.
Approximately 250,000 ballots are being processed in the county, but only votes for District 2 will be counted. Cochise County is also included and will start its recount on December 8th. The Secretary of State is required to report recount results no later than 5 p.m. on December 16th. Kate Sheehy, KJZZ News, Tucson.
Later this month, the Police Officers of Scottsdale Association will host its 12th annual Christmas Shop with a Cop event, where underprivileged kids go on a shopping spree with police officers. It's one of two signature events for kids the union raises money for year-round. But as KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen reports, only a fraction of the donations are actually going to the causes.
The union's Back to School and Christmas Shop with a Cop events help hundreds of needy kids every year. And union president Jim Hill says they recently split the Christmas event into 2 days to accommodate teenagers. He spoke about it while at a fundraiser car wash in Scottsdale last month.
Because we still have Santa there, you know, a 13-year-old's like, Santa. Meanwhile, the 8-year-old's like, Santa!
Few things tug at the heartstrings more than cops helping underprivileged kids, and the numbers show it. The union's tax records show that annual donations for the programs jumped by more than 82% between 2006 and 2012. In total, almost $4.5 million was raised over that 7-year period. But how much actually reaches the kids? Not much. Sometimes less than 10%. That's because 2/3 automatically go to a for-profit telemarketing firm called PFR Promotions, which does all of the union's fundraising. The union keeps the remaining third, but after operating expenses, not much is left for the kids. Take 2010, for example. More than $500,000 was raised, yet only $47,000 was spent on the kids' programs. That's less than 9% of all donations that year. Hill says there's no way they spent so little, and his past treasurer must have made a mistake.
If there's 200,000 kept there and only 45 was spent, then we should have 150 grand laying around, and I have no idea where that would be.
He declined to look back at his files to set the record straight for the purpose of this story, but he defended the telemarketing expenses.
You know, fundraising is a necessary, called evil, of the business. If you want to raise that kind of money, you're going to have to spend the money to have somebody go out and do it for you.
Nonprofit experts say telemarketers are notorious for taking huge chunks of the money they raise. And in recent years, it's put big charities like the American Cancer Society and the American Diabetes Association under scrutiny. Sandra Minuti at Charity Navigator, a nonprofit watchdog group, says it's just plain deceptive to donors, and it's something the industry frowns upon.
To be sending two-thirds, I don't know that there's ever a rational reason that could justify that. That's just way out of the norm. And not necessary.
Ron Sellers, a nonprofit consultant at Gray Matter Research in Phoenix, says telemarketing could be justified if
you're able to turn those one-time donors into multiple-time donors or sustainers, then what seems on the short term to be a very questionable or even bad investment, long term can turn into a fantastic investment.
But if the union consistently raises more money than it needs, he says the programs should be expanded or fundraising be scaled back. Now, Hill says the programs have grown over the years, although he couldn't say by how much. And tax records show program expenses have actually stayed roughly the same, while donations have grown substantially. Also, PFR, the telemarketer, shares an office space with the union in downtown Scottsdale after relocating from Tucson a few years ago. Hill says that was his idea because it made things easier. And Sellers says
that's unusual. I wouldn't necessarily go so far as to say that's problematic or unethical.
But Michael Nielsen with the Association of Fundraising Professionals disagrees.
To me, that's even more troublesome because you need to have some arm's length there. Frankly, that's a huge red flag.
He says his organization tells people to be careful with telemarketers, and that gets touchy when dealing with groups like police and fire unions. But Minuti at Charity Navigator says that's when donors should be most cautious.
People don't necessarily stop and think, where's my money going? They just hear, help a sick kid or help your local fireman or policeman, and we give with our heart, and people don't use their head, because if they knew that two-thirds of what they gave was being kept by the for-profit firm, nobody would give.
So while needy kids shopping with cops for Christmas is a noble cause, Minuti says hang up the phone and do some research first. Christina Hansen, KJZZ News.
Arizona joined with 37 other states this week in asking the Federal Trade Commission to update something called the Telemarketing Sales Rule. That's the provision that established the Do Not Call Registry and generally regulates how many telemarketing calls people can get at home. Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn says he and his fellow attorneys general want the FTC to make four changes to the measure.
This is to tighten up the rules on telemarketing. The first thing that we're asking for is that they stop creating what they call sucker lists, which means that you give a telemarketer, you decide to buy something and you give them your credit card information, and then they sell your name and phone number and the credit card information to a company that sells it to other telemarketers, and you know, you're on a sucker list and you get calls from all different telemarketers. We would like to prohibit that. The second change is to require that telemarketers give you a chance to say no. After they give you their pitch, they have to say, do you want this or do you not want this, as opposed to just giving you a pitch, and if you don't say no, them assuming that they can go ahead and sign you up. Then the third change would be to require them to keep call records so that if they're defrauding people, we as the attorney generals can call the people that they've called and find out what they were told and see if they were defrauded. And then the last change we're asking for has to do with payment methods, to stop a payment method such as asking for your checking account number and your routing number so that they can generate checks, which makes it much easier for you to get defrauded or cash cards, limited pretty much to checks and regular credit cards.
What kind of impact would that sort of thing have on a place like Arizona, which has so many call centers?
Well, you know, I have always felt that the work we do to protect consumers from fraud is very much something that is a good for business, because ethical business people shouldn't have to compete with unethical ones. So to the extent we eliminate fraud and crack down on it, that helps the honest people in business to flourish.
Do you anticipate, or have you already gotten pushback from the telemarketing industry on this?
I'm not sure on these particular ones. I think there were a number of proposals that they did push back on, things that would be very expensive, such as recording calls or maintaining copies of their scripts and other things that would occur to us as things that would be helpful, but the industry says it would be too expensive, and the Federal Trade Commission has to balance, you know, our efforts to combat fraud with undue expense on the industry.
Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn. Tom, thanks.
Thank you.
Personalized medicine has become a popular buzzword in the healthcare field, but researchers at ASU and IBM are hoping to make things a lot more personal. They're working on a handheld device that could read a patient's DNA from a very small amount of blood, spit, or other fluid. Stuart Lindsay is a physics professor at ASU and director of the Biodesign Institute Center for Single Molecule Biophysics.
There's been a project at the National Institutes of Health for a decade or so now to build a $1,000 genome decoder. And actually, we're well past that point now. Sequencing genes is cheaper than that. But the point is, a lot of new technology has been developed that allows you to do the molecular profile of individual humans at amounts that are going to be ridiculously cheap. And our plan is to build a very small handheld whole genome sequencer, and indeed something also that can look at all of the proteins in a human body.
So when I hear this, I'm picturing one of those scanners that at the doctor's office they swipe across your forehead to take your temperature. Is that kind of what we're talking about here?
That's feasible in the not-too-distant future, absolutely. We're taking instruments that were once benchtop and turning them into microchips, and that's what the latest work is all about.
So how exactly does that tell a physician or anyone else what is in your DNA?
Well, so I think one of the surprises of modern medicine is how incredibly different every individual is. And this means that our reaction to medication, our prognosis, and so on, depend on our unique molecular makeup. Doctors are very good at guessing how to treat you, but a future is not too far away where we will be able to predict the correct treatment for a particular type of molecular makeup, and that will change medicine.
So typically when you think about finding stuff like this out, there's blood work, there's some kind of scan or something like that. How will this device actually tell a doctor what's inside you?
So the device itself will provide the information about the molecular makeup of every individual. Now, there's a huge leap between having that data and being able to use it to predict health outcomes. But companies like IBM, you've probably heard of the project, you know, the Watson project that won Jeopardy, are using machine intelligence to interpret this vast amount of molecular information we're getting now and turn it into action items for doctors. So devices like this, coupled with modern computer machine learning technology, will actually do things that no human doctor could ever do.
So when you say this is getting really, really cheap, I mean, how cheap are we talking?
So right now, it's already under $1,000 to have a whole genome sequenced, which is staggering. The original genome cost billions of dollars. So that in itself is amazing. But I can see costs for a genome going down to, you know, a few dollars, a few tens of dollars.
What additional education or training would physicians need to be able to take that information and adjust your medication dosage or put you on a totally different medication or different treatment altogether?
So it's a task that, with, you know, respect to wonderfully qualified and talented physicians, is really above the capabilities of any one physician. So it would require years of acquisition of clinical information and training of the type of machine learning algorithms that corporations like IBM are developing. But at the end of all of this, there really would be simple yes-no advice to doctors who then use that in collaboration with their own good judgment to take a course of action that may be quite different for one patient presenting with a set of symptoms than from another.
Are there ethical questions about this kind of technology in your mind? I'm thinking about that sort of proverbial question, you know, if you could know in your 20s that you'll develop Alzheimer's later on, would you want to know? I mean, are you grappling with questions like that?
So that's at the that's on the mind of everyone developing technology like this. But that's something for the medical community to figure out and for individuals to figure out. I mean, it seems to me that the potential benefits of having this type of molecular information are so overwhelming that taking steps to handle the ethical concerns of individuals, I mean, they're needed, but they certainly shouldn't stop the advance of technologies like this.
So how long do you think it'll be until I can go to my doctor's office and they can take a quick blood draw and tell me what's in my DNA?
I think it's going to be quite a few years. To begin with, to go from a demonstration of a device, which is what we have right now, to an FDA-approved device is a many, many year process. It's going to be even harder here because this flood of data is going to have to be assimilated and understood in the medical community. So if I had to guess, I would say it's going to be 10 or 20 years before this impacts medicine routinely. I would make the comment, though, that it's always shocking to me how quickly things advance these days, and I might be wrong on the other side. Of course, I could equally be wrong. 20 years might be optimistic.
Stuart Lindsay is director of the ASU Biodesign Institute Center for Single Molecule Biophysics. As he referenced, as we get more access to our own genetic makeups, there are ethical and moral issues that pop up. To talk about some of them, we turn to Art Kaplan, who heads up the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Langone Medical Center. He likes what Lindsay and others are working on.
We certainly are moving toward a time in medicine where one size fits all treatments are not going to be the way medicine is practiced. People are different biologically. So it is going to become important to be able to tailor drug treatment or different types of vaccines or different types of therapies to particular people.
What types of questions should patients be asking their physicians or maybe even asking themselves about potentially having this kind of information?
So while I think it's a good technology and one that would help make medicine more precise and more effective, it has ethical issues that need to be addressed. One is you need to ask your doctor, when's the last time you had a course in genetics? If you bring a profile of genetic information to a lot of physicians, they're going to say, you know what, I didn't have that in medical school. I don't know how to interpret this. I don't exactly know what to make of this. So sometimes you can overwhelm the doctor with genetic information that they're not trained to understand or to interpret. Another problem is a lot of this information is about risk factors. So it's one thing to say you've got a disease. It's another thing to say you're at high risk for diabetes or asthma or something like that. Well, if you're testing a child, we have enough problem these days with helicopter parents anyway. If you say your kid's at risk of this or at risk of that, are you going to overreact? Life is full of risks. And we can try to manage them, but I do worry that if you got a genetic profile on your offspring and it showed certain risks of certain things, while it's reasonable to try and give them a good diet, it's reasonable to try and make sure they exercise and so on, it's not reasonable to drive them berserk. So I think those are potential problems.
Along those lines, I mean, is it possible, do you think, to have this kind of genetic information about yourself or maybe about your kids and not do something about it, not sort of change the way you either parent your kids or live your own life?
So it's interesting. I think there are two kinds of folks out there with information. One group is very zealous about using information and almost prone to overreaction. The other style is information doesn't move them. So I think you're going to see a distribution, some people handling the information well, some people, a minority, overreacting, and we're going to have to manage that. And some people just sort of sitting there saying, yeah, I have a risk of diabetes, pass me another bag of potato chips.
Do you think that this kind of information or the potential for physicians to have this kind of information will change in any way the relationship between doctor and patient?
I do. I think when you start to do routine genetic testing, you start to manage more conditions. You start to swing toward prevention a little bit away from therapy because you get that risk profile that's down there. You also start to blame the patient more. You know, let's face it, if I work in an industrial plant and I'm exposed to pollutants, if I work in mining, these things can make me sick. But because I'm doing genetic testing, the argument is, well, maybe you shouldn't work there because your biology is more at risk, or maybe you should do things to minimize your risk, like wear a mask. But it diminishes the emphasis on saying, hey, maybe we should make the workplace safer. One sort of nasty impact of genetics is it turns to you as the source of where the problem is, and a lot of the problems we deal with are out there.
How long do you think it'll be realistically before we can go to our doctor's offices and really get this kind of detailed genetic information?
I think you're going to see this within the next 5 years. I think it's coming pretty fast. What I think is not coming quite as fast is the therapies that are targeted to you. Those things aren't here yet. But I do think you'll see the testing and some of the risk profiling pretty quick.
Art Kaplan heads up the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center. Still to come, did you get a smoking deal on Black Friday? Maybe Thanksgiving night? Maybe Cyber Monday?
What does that mean for the profits? You know, sales may be up 2%, but I doubt profits will be up.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on 91.5 KJZZ. Quick check of Valley traffic. There's a vehicle fire on the 60 westbound at Sossaman. Looks like the rain has pretty much cleared away, but look for cloudy skies to remain across the valley today with a high of 71. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. 66 degrees right now at KJZZ at 224.
KJZZ is supported by Ballet Arizona, celebrating the season with the Nutcracker, December 12th through the 28th at Symphony Hall. Dance to Tchaikovsky's famous score performed live by the Phoenix Symphony. Tickets at balletaz.org.
Are you done with your holiday shopping yet? Based on when some stores started their Black Friday deals, you could have been done before your turkey was fully digested. Joining me now to talk about the lengthening of the holiday shopping season is Phoenix-based retail analyst Jeff Green. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
So how is the holiday shopping season doing so far?
Well, it's a very confusing shopping season. Number one, it got started extremely early this year. And in fact, those doorbusters, those deep discount products that have gone on sale actually started this year, right around November 1st. Typically, they've been basically Black Friday deals, and last year that sort of bled into Thanksgiving Day.
So when we look at Black Friday numbers and we look at Cyber Monday numbers, do we have to take into account how much earlier things are starting now?
Yes. The fact that it appears that the Black Friday weekend, I'm referring to Thanksgiving through Sunday, along with Cyber Monday, sales were a little bit lower than last year. It's not a real fair comparison because the season got started so early.
Do you think this trend is going to continue where stores just start these Christmas and holiday sales earlier and earlier?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's competing for the same retail dollar. So they want you in their store first.
Well, how early do you think is too early?
Well, I think November 1st is too early. However, it'll bleed into October next year.
When you look at Black Friday, and now that's obviously bled into Thanksgiving Day on Thursday, then you have Small Business Saturday and Cyber Monday. Do all of these events, if you want to call them events, have sort of different attributes and different characteristics, or is it all basically just about retail shopping?
Actually, it's just about retail shopping, and it's just about marketing, really. I mean, it's marketing to the same shopper, but to try to get them in more often by having each of those days sort of labeled.
How do locally owned, sort of smaller, independent businesses compete with the big chains, the big box stores, on all of these shopping days?
Actually, this shopping local idea, small business shopping, is actually increasing quite a bit. I've read some statistics that talk about how well local bookstores are now doing.
So are stores able to compete both in brick-and-mortar locations and online, or do they tend to focus on one or the other?
Well, the chains have to be multi-distribution channels. They've got to be experts at both brick-and-mortar and online. Now, the smaller local chains have a much harder time getting a strong online presence, and that's just because it requires so much upfront capital.
So do they tend to rely then more on that specific Small Business Saturday to actually get people in their doors?
Yeah, they do, through their brick-and-mortar store.
When all is said and done, after December 25th, where do you think this holiday shopping season will rate compared to the previous few years?
Well, I think it's going to be somewhere between being flat to up a percent or two. You know, the fact that the Black Friday weekend was so tepid at best, and maybe offset a little bit by earlier shopping, it certainly doesn't seem like it's going to be that good a season. But I think the bigger question is, okay, what happens now in January and February when retailers start reporting their earnings, and so much of holiday shopping has been promotional or on-sale shopping? What does that mean for the profits? You know, sales may be up 2%, but I doubt profits will be up.
Phoenix-based retail consultant Jeff Green is president of Jeff Green Partners. Jeff, thanks as always.
Thank you, Mark.
Jeff referenced Cyber Monday, and as e-commerce has grown, so too has the impact of taxes collected from online sales. But they're not collected uniformly across the country, and Congress's efforts to change that have so far been unsuccessful. Bill Fox is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Tennessee and says in many cases, Cyber Monday is one of the most wonderful times of the year.
Well, it certainly would be a big day for sales tax collections. While there are some issues with collecting sales taxes on remote transactions, most of the tax is in fact collected. And so when you have such a big day as, you know, occurs on Cyber Mondays, states surely also will get a lot of revenues. Now, of course, that won't come to them till next month, but when they see the collections for January, they'll continue to be increased by good sales.
Do states that do not collect online sales tax look at the holiday shopping season and say, wow, we could really make some good money here?
Every state that has a sales tax imposes the sales tax on internet transactions just in the same way it does on sales in bricks and mortar stores. The only difference is who collects it. If you're in a bricks and mortar store, what happens is the vendor collects and it sends in a check on your behalf. If you buy something online, it depends. If you're buying from, say, Walmart.com, they're going to be collecting the tax for Arizona and remitting the tax just as if it had been purchased in the store. If, on the other hand, you purchase from a remote vendor that's not collecting for Arizona, then what happens is the individual buyer is responsible to submit the use tax.
Do buyers tend to pay that tax?
Okay, so there's the tricky part, and there's the problem, and this is why it's getting so much attention with the states pressuring Congress to pass a bill. What happens is if it's a company that's making this taxable purchase, the best research suggests that they'll pay about 75% of what's due. If it's individuals making these purchases, like you and I, in our role as, you know, as a household, not much gets paid. And, you know, if we buy a car, then we register it in most cases in the state, and we'll pay the sales tax then. But if people buy, you know, music or books or, you know, food is in the sales taxable states for food, then they don't pay very much.
So this issue of what's called the Marketplace Fairness Act, which would essentially collect taxes on online sales everywhere, has been sort of floating around out there for a while. Do you think there's more incentive now or more initiative now to try to get it passed?
Well, we're at least the fourth version of similar legislation in recent years. And, of course, the House of Representatives has now passed the Marketplace Fairness Act of 2013. We'll see whether over the next few weeks the Senate passes the legislation as well. If not, I'm sure some new iteration of this will come up over the next couple of years. The pressure for it has been growing because e-commerce is growing fast. I should note, this is not a new issue. There was analysis of this very same issue associated with mail order sales 20 years ago. And in fact, an organization that he operated under the guise of the federal government for a long time called the Advisory Commission of Intergovernmental Relations did a study on mail order sales in 1994 and said states were losing $3 billion or something like that from mail order. So the issue is not new. What's happened, however, is that e-commerce has grown so fast that the implications of you know, difficulties in collecting this tax revenue have grown over the last 20 years, and to where now, you know, even in 2012, the estimates were $23, $24 billion that wasn't being collected, and that number is growing year by year.
Bill Fox is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Tennessee. Bill, thanks so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
It's the show on KJZZ. Goldfield is a ghost town near the Superstition Mountains. The town experienced its heyday in the late 1800s, but is now a popular tourist destination. Visitors can tour a gold mine, ride a train, or play with a kid-friendly fake shooting range. These are the sounds of the city.
I'm Joan Hartley from Ottumwa, Iowa, and we're up here at Goldfield visiting the old place. There's a bunch of old buildings that are like 1800s. They've been here for such a long time, and I like old things. They have all kinds of little shops. They have Indian jewelry and great food. We had coffee and little rolls here this morning. It was just wonderful. It's fun. It's much fun.
That's Joan Hartley exploring the shops and restaurant of a ghost town at Goldfield, Arizona. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix, Phoenix, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. Coming up, undergrads at the University of Arizona get paid to make sure student-athletes are performing in the classroom.
I think the student-athletes know that there are potential checkers out there for the class, so I think knowing that helps motivate them to get there.
That's just ahead. It's the show. Look for the clouds to stick around for much of the rest of the day with a high of 71 degrees. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight. Overnight lows near 56. It's 66 degrees right now at KJZZ. And on the US 60 westbound, a vehicle fire at Sossaman.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A judge in New York has released some of the details of the grand jury proceeding in the case of Eric Garner, the African-American man who died after being put in a chokehold by a white police officer. The grand jury heard from 50 witnesses and reviewed dozens of pieces of evidence, including four videos, before deciding not to charge the officer. That decision has prompted demonstrations in New York and a number of other cities. NPR's Zoe Chase reports civil rights advocate Al Sharpton is calling for a march on Washington next week in light of this latest instance of a grand jury declining to indict a white police officer in the death of an unarmed black man.
Neither the officer who killed Michael Brown in Ferguson or the officer who killed Eric Garner in Staten Island were indicted by the grand juries. That means, as of now, neither officer is charged with a crime. Al Sharpton says the grand jury system in this country is broken.
We hope this march begins a series of efforts that will lead to how we redo the grand jury review of policing in this country.
Other groups supporting the call for a march on Washington include the NAACP and the National Urban League. Zoe Chase, NPR News, New York.
The Pentagon is acknowledging undertaking a hostage rescue mission last month in Yemen, but U.S. forces failed to rescue American Luke Summers because he was not present at the targeted location. Summers is the only American among the roughly one dozen hostages that were being held by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The Pentagon says the rescue operation did free eight of those other hostages. House Republicans have passed a bill denouncing President Obama's executive actions on immigration and declaring them null and void, but the vote was largely symbolic because the bill stands no chance in the Democratic-controlled Senate and faces a veto threat from the president. Wall Street today, the Dow closed down 12 points to end at 17,900. The Nasdaq was off 5 points. This is NPR News.
KJZZ is supported by Make-A-Wish Arizona. Granting the wishes of Arizona children with life-threatening medical conditions, you can help grant a wish by sharing your extra airline miles today. Arizona.wish.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. The head of the UN Ebola mission in West Africa has warned there's still a huge risk that the deadly disease could spread to other parts of the world. But the truth is that, so far at least, the vast majority of the 16,000 cases and more than 6,000 deaths have been in three countries: Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. Neighboring nations may have escaped the epidemic, but they haven't escaped its effects. According to the UN, tourism in Gambia has dropped by at least 60% because of the Ebola outbreak. The BBC's Brioni Williams has been to Kololi, one of the main tourist areas of Gambia.
The roaring sound of waves rushing along the sand to shore, the perfect soundtrack to anyone's holiday. I'm standing on Senegambia Beach, about 30 minutes' drive outside the capital, Banjul. And even though I'm hundreds of kilometres from countries where the Ebola virus has claimed the lives of thousands, the impact can be felt in the Gambia too. Sun lounges are empty and hotels look tired and desperate for business. The holidaymakers that are here can see the effect it's having.
I'm from the north of Holland, near Assen, Groningen, and I will say to the Holland people, come to the Gambia, the land of the smiley coast. Huh?
Do you think people are afraid to come here because of Ebola then?
Yes, they're very afraid for Ebola. And in Holland they said, oh, the Ebola in West Africa, don't go too. But I have my friend here and I asked him and he said, there's no Ebola. Everybody's happy here.
Year 2000 was probably the first time we come out to the Gambia.
Have you seen tourism drop off this year?
Remarkably so. In the last fortnight that we've been here, the tourism's well down. You know, obviously because of the Ebola scare and people are frightened to come, but it didn't put us off.
It's breakfast service at the Seaview Gardens Hotel. A selection of teas, coffees, fresh fruit, cheeses and meats. The only thing that's missing are the guests.
My name is Alu F. Jalo. I'm the duty manager of Seaview Garden Hotel.
You've had to cordon off part of the hotel. Is that because guests just aren't coming here?
Yeah, this time we don't have enough people coming here. That's why we don't operate the other side of the rooms. And secondly, because of this Ebola. Before Ebola, it was booked up to April, full book, 45 rooms. But because of this Ebola, all they cancelled their coming to the Gambia. And now we are using only 24 rooms. Only quarter of the staff are working right now here. All the rest sitting at home because of this Ebola.
Mbuba Seka is one of those. He used to work here but hasn't been employed again because the hotel just isn't busy enough.
I'm married with two kids. Yeah, I'm from a village and all the family are in the village. I normally come here during the season to work for 6 months, and then after the 6 months I go back to the village. And whatever I have, I send it to the village for them to buy rice and feed themselves. Since the Ebola outbreak, it's really affect us. Since the Ebola outbreak this season, the most hotels didn't open, or if they opened, they call half of their staff. It's really affecting me and my family because I'm the breadwinner of my family. I work, whatever I have, I send it to them, they buy rice and eat.
What happens when there are no people here and you still can't find work?
That will be a crisis for the Gambia and for many people.
That's the BBC's Brioni Williams. The Tempe Union School District Governing Board has approved a sex education curriculum after a year of debate. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports the resolution didn't satisfy most of the stakeholders.
Board members, parents, and people from the community spent more than an hour discussing the sex education curriculum Wednesday night. Many took issue with how it approached contraceptives and abortion, because some, like Peggy McLean, believe certain contraceptives are abortion.
You are talking about abortion. You're not using the A word, but you are talking about it. You're talking around it. Why don't you just talk about abortion? Why don't you talk about the scientific truths about abortion, the physical, emotional, scientific effects, the process of how it's done? Let's be honest with these kids.
Tempe Union approved the curriculum with additions to some controversial sections. The amended program has teachers explain to students there are multiple theories about when pregnancy begins, and depending on your belief, some methods of contraception are seen by some to terminate a pregnancy. 10th grade students will be taught this 10-day program in their health class. Governing board member David Shapira says the board wants consistency.
We're trying to make sure that the sex ed class taught at McClintock High School is the same as the one taught at Desert Vista or Mountain Point or Corona or Tempe High and Marcos. And so I think this successfully does that. Now, there's quite a few compromises.
Among others, this includes the ability for parents to choose alternative curricula. The board passed this as an opt-in program, so parents have to sign a letter allowing their kids to take the class. No word yet on when it will be implemented in the classroom. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Tempe.
Despite the increasing number of states allowing same-sex marriage, the country's largest American Indian reservation does not. But the Navajo Nation will soon have a new president, and that's led some to speculate the Dene Marriage Act of 2005, which prohibits same-sex marriages, may be up for review. To find out more, we reached out to Shaundine Silversmith, a reporter for the Navajo Times, who's written a lot about this issue.
In all honesty, I think that the topic has come to light a lot more in the recent months, especially since New Mexico and Arizona now acknowledge same-sex marriage, and most recently Arizona. So I feel that with the new administration coming in, it'll probably be an even bigger topic now that Arizona acknowledges same-sex marriage. As of lately, I haven't heard any updates on any resolutions or legislatives trying to challenge the Dene Marriage Act of 2005, which bans same-sex marriage on the Navajo Nation.
There are a lot of issues that the Navajo Nation deals with and that lawmakers and tribal officials have to deal with. So how big of a priority do you think an issue like same-sex marriage might be compared to all the other myriad things that they have to deal with?
In the responses that I've gotten as a reporter, a majority of the time, that is the biggest issue. The fact that a lot of community members or people on the Navajo Nation don't see same-sex marriage a priority. They don't see it as something that needs to be addressed right now, because there are so many different issues that face the Navajo Nation that should be addressed, they feel.
Was this an issue at all in the presidential campaigns or in any of the tribal legislative campaigns?
Well, during the campaigning period where there were so many candidates and there were a variety of different forums, a few times at these forums that it was brought up, and the way that some of the candidates responded is that they don't see a problem with same-sex couples, or they don't see why that the Navajo Nation doesn't take off that law, or they're in support of same-sex couples, but there was no direct, I guess, notion to how they would overturn the Dene Marriage Act of 2005, or no direct motion of how they would help same-sex couples gain that right.
Shaundine Silversmith is a reporter with the Navajo Times. Shaundine, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Quick check of traffic. I-17 northbound, an accident at Peoria. I-17 southbound, an accident at Northern. And there's a vehicle fire on the 60 westbound at Sossaman. Should stay cloudy for the rest of the afternoon, at least partly cloudy with a high of 71. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight as well, with overnight lows in the mid-50s. Then partly cloudy skies again for tomorrow with a high of 75. 66 degrees at KJZZ at 2:46.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering chef-prepared dinners and catered party trays, fine wines paired with artisan cheeses, and festive desserts for all your entertaining needs. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
Congress today voted to approve the National Defense Authorization Act, which funds the Defense Department. More than 1,000 pages into that bill is a provision authorizing a land exchange, which would allow a mining company to drill for copper near Superior. The Resolution Copper Mine has been in the works for several years. Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar has been one of the project's main supporters.
I think this is a golden opportunity to say thanks to Arizona, and hopefully with the Senate's blessings, we'll have a copper Christmas.
How optimistic are you that the Senate will take up this bill and keep this provision in it?
I'm confident in our two senators, especially Senator McCain, who has been championing it on the Senate side. We've been working hand in hand with the Senate, so no move hasn't gone unnoticed on either side.
Some critics of this project have complained that the environmental impact statement provision of this particular bill would basically go against the look before you leap sentiment that other federal law goes for and wouldn't require the environmental work to be done before the land is exchanged. Is that a concern for you?
That's false. You know, never before have we ever had a NEPA done before. This just happens to be in this aspect is a NEPA will actually occur before land is exchanged from title from the government to Resolution Copper. So right now they're in the mine plan of operations, and that is a requirement. We've said so from the very get-go. So it just happens that it's at this time. But no other project that we know of, and that was brought up in the hearings, in an exchange of property, has ever had to have a pre-exchange NEPA. Never.
There's been some talk about the fact that this provision was put into a basically unrelated bill. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about the fact that this copper mining project is in a defense spending bill.
Well, this is nothing new, Mark. I mean, what we've seen this is over the last 25 years, things have been attached to the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. So this is nothing new. And in this case, we're seeing a higher reliance on rare earths, copper, and essential minerals. And this is an important part because we're importing almost 35% of our copper in our country. There's an increased demand for copper. And this mine itself would produce 25% of the demand of the United States.
In a perfect world, would you like to see these bills not have provisions like this kind of thing on them?
I'd like to see cleaner bills, but what's end up happening is change is slow, and we've seen this year where the Senate has done relatively nothing while the House has been extremely busy. And so you take the opportunity to lead when that movement occurs.
Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Mark.
But critics of the project are less excited about today's vote. Sandy Barr, director of the Grand Canyon chapter of the Sierra Club, says her group's been fighting the mine project for several years and hopes the mine provision is removed from the bill before it gets to the president.
Overall, the bills have always been bad, and this one is no exception.
Does the environmental review stipulation not satisfy the need that you have to make sure this is not going to be a real problem?
Not at all. It's really a joke. The idea that you do an environmental review after a land exchange goes through, that's contrary to the whole idea behind the National Environmental Policy Act. The National Environmental Policy Act is a law that is intended to promote a look before you leap philosophy. So you look at the environmental impacts, you look at the cost, you look at the benefits, all of those things, and you actually look at a range of alternatives. This is, you know, when the bill passes, it's a done deal.
What do you think of the fact that this provision, which has, as you said, been around for a very long time, gets slipped into this bill that's, you know, several hundred pages long?
It's outrageous. It's why people hold Congress in such low regard, this type of activity. It's unrelated. It's totally unrelated to the Defense Authorization Act. It's a bill that could not get through on its own. They brought it to the floor in the House, but then pulled it. So it's something that can't stand alone as an issue. So they basically sneak it into another bill at the last minute. I mean, it really is the last minute. They're planning to wrap up next week, and you'll have a new Congress in January. So it's just outrageous, and I think really drives home the point that this is bad public policy, and it's bad for the American public. It's a huge ripoff. And it will destroy an area that is important to many, many Arizonans, but people from around the country have spoke up about this, including the National Congress of American Indians.
Sandy Barr with the Grand Canyon chapter of the Sierra Club. Sandy, thanks.
Thank you.
Officials from the U.S. Census Bureau are preparing for a data collection test in Maricopa County next year. They'll reach out to 1.6 million homes in the valley in an attempt to try out new technology and management practices. Regional Director Kathy Lacey says they'll be trying some ideas prompted by the 2010 census.
We're trying to figure out how can we reduce the cost of the census? So one is we wanted to use smartphones and use an automated device in 2010, but we just didn't make it. So we'll absolutely be doing that in the 2020 census. We wanted to use internet, but our research showed that the same people would mail back a questionnaire are the same people that would respond by the internet. A lot has happened since 2010. We're no longer seeing that to be the trend. So the internet option is also a big deal. We're testing out the use of administrative records. First of all, we have to validate that these records are as good as what a respondent would fill out on their questionnaire or what we would see if we'd go to their door. That's going to be a huge reducer as far as cost, so the use of administrative record. We are actually looking at utilizing a different management structure. We've been using the same management structure since the beginning of time or beginning of the census, and we're actually looking at streamlining that structure, increasing the amount of automation, and trying to use more cost-effective routing and assignments based on where people actually live and where the cases are actually located. So this is a huge test for us, and a lot of decisions will be made based on the results.
Lacey says they chose the area for its diverse demographics.
This area has a large Hispanic population, which has traditionally been hard to count, and we want to be able to gauge the impact of various new processes on response rate for this demographic area.
Those processes include a new online submission process, as well as having census takers record data to an app on their mobile phones. Despite recent commercial data breaches, Lacey says respondents shouldn't worry about their personal information being compromised.
The security that we have for the census data can actually be compared to the military. It's extremely secure, and that's actually one of the reasons we did not use the internet option in 2010, because we weren't as confident. We've actually been testing with the American Community Survey with an internet option, and we've had no breaches, no concerns whatsoever. Because we will be using handheld devices on the field, meaning that the census workers that we hire actually go through a background clearance. We will supply them with a smartphone. They'll have an app that we have already downloaded onto their device, and they actually log into the cloud. So the census cloud. So there's nothing that's actually on their device that, even if the device is stolen, no one can get into the cloud, which contains all the census data that we're collecting.
Valley residents should begin hearing from the Census Bureau in March. The University of Arizona Athletics Department is taking a creative approach to ensure student-athletes show up to class. They've begun hiring undergrads to monitor attendance levels. Too many misses could result in a suspension from sports programs, but Associate Athletic Director John Mosbach says it hasn't turned students against each other.
We have staff that go out and will check the classes of students, and they will be there 15 minutes before class starts, stay till about 15 minutes after, not engaging with the student, not engaging with the professor, essentially just there to make sure that they're on time, they're attending. Send it over to Sarah Howard, who coordinates our class checking efforts, who disseminates that to our counselors on a daily, and then the counselors will then put that information in a daily report and send to the coaches.
Now, when you say staff, these are mostly other students, right?
Correct. Yeah. Our class checkers are, right now we have 5 undergrad and then 1 grad-seeking student that help us out with the actual on-the-ground class checking efforts.
And these students get paid, right?
Correct. Yes.
Have you run into any problems where, for example, I can imagine a situation where a student is a big football or basketball fan and, you know, doesn't want to get the star quarterback or star basketball player in trouble for missing a class, so, you know, maybe they fudge the numbers a little bit. Has that been an issue for you?
No, I don't believe that's an issue for us. I mean, the first day of training, we go through and make sure that integrity is at the core of this process and what we're doing. And that's why we set some of those practices in place, such as, you know, students, class checkers not interacting with the student athletes so that they don't have the opportunity or window for them to know each other. So really for the student athletes, they really have no idea who that person may be checking their class. So I think that protects us. But again, you know, we stress the integrity of the program and what we're trying to do, and look, when we're hiring and selecting folks, that we know we'll go about it and do it the right way.
Do you find that the students that you hire to do this generally are familiar with the athletes that they're checking on, or are they students who maybe don't have a great interest in sports?
I'd say we get a little bit of both. Certainly, I know we've had some that really have no clue to who or what, you know, and not much into athletics. They see it as a student position that they want to come in and do well and do right. And we give the information of the bio or a picture for a student. I think by the nature of being a student, being on campus, some are probably in tune with athletics and some of the individuals. So I think you get a handful on each side.
Would you say that this system has so far been fairly effective in terms of making sure student athletes go to class and stay in class?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is a small sliver of the comprehensive support that we're giving our student athletes. And so I think it's helping. I don't think this is the number one, you know, part of what we're doing to support our students. So, like as I mentioned, getting progress reports from the faculty are certainly a crucial part in helping out with this. I think it's good to know that I think the student athletes know that there are potential checkers out there for the class. So I think knowing that helps motivate them to get there, and just have us having more information and being ahead on things, I think helps us be successful as a whole as a program. Yeah.
And just out of curiosity, what's the procedure if a student athlete misses a class or misses multiple classes? What are the guidelines for how many absences they're allowed, and what happens if they exceed that?
It starts with 3 misses, and that's a warning to the student athlete that they had 3 misses and that a next absence could warrant a suspension. And a suspension after that would be for 4 misses, would be a 10%, and then incrementally on up. And again, it's at the discretion of the athletic director on how he would like to handle those situations.
John Mosbach is Associate Athletic Director of CATS Academics at the University of Arizona. John, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. In a few weeks, we'll bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pavlovich. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this word puzzle. The day before yesterday, I was 25, and the next year, I will be 28. This is true only one day in a year. What day is my birthday? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw 2 names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. The show was produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. Be back with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by St. Barnabas on the Desert, Scottsdale, presenting Advent Lessons and Carols with Choir, Harp, and Renaissance Instruments this Saturday, December 6th at 4 p.m. Info at stbarnabas.org.